Okay, welcome to our regular work session of July 6th, 2020. It's 5:31, and I'm going to have, I just wanted to thank Phoebe for filling in as our clerk today. Karen is actually taking some well-deserved time off. So thanks, Phoebe, for filling in. And Phoebe, if you want to do roll, that'd be great.
Mayor Cassapit?
Yes. Here.
Vice Mayor Cattimore?
Here.
Councilmember Clark?
Here.
Councilmember Owens? Welcome back to her. Councilmember Taylor? Councilmember Taylor? Councilmember Warner?
I'm here.
Councilmember Vanderzanden?
Here.
Okay, Shelley or Mike, are you on?
Yes, I'm on. My volume was off, sorry.
Okay.
Shelley's here.
Okay.
I'm here.
Present.
Okay, great. Thanks, everybody. First, I wanted to have Travis give us an update. our incident commander, give us an update on COVID-19. So, Travis, if you don't mind, if you want to start.
Yeah, thank you. So, I'm going to start real fast. I'm going to move around on my things here. I want to give out the Gus Davis total numbers as of this morning around 8 a.m. Search gave me the most current data that they have for what's happened in Gus Davis. So we've tested 134 people. We've received 117 tests back. We have 18 test results pending, 115 negatives, one positive, one recovered case, zero hospitalizations, zero resident cases, and one non-resident case. So those are the Gus Davis numbers. I want to give you a quick overview of what's happened over out at the airport so far. So real fast, first week and a half or so, they used a version one form. And then on the 11th, they switched to a version two form. So the version two form is the one they've stuck with. So I've compiled both forms as best as I can to do this. And some data we didn't start research or keeping track of until a little bit more recently and stuff like that. So it's not, some of it's not the best, but it's fairly close. So we've had, what we've counted is 292 total passengers. And I know that that number is not the best number. There's more than that that have come in. That's one of our spots that isn't the best number. We started counting that one late. And also 88 intrastate travelers counted so far. And that's counted, started after the 11th, where we started counting on that one on version two. So we missed a few of those, but those are, you know, within about 10 or 15, I would say, on each of them, or maybe 30 on the total passengers overall. But other than that, we've collected 234 state declaration forms so far. And I'll just run over the numbers real fast. It's going to sound like a lot, and I'm going to put this out and just add it in all weekend. So it'll come out probably tomorrow sometime. So we've got 106 people that have tested within 72 hours that came in with results. 56 of those people were just waiting for those results within 72 hours. Within the five-day bracket, we're 23 people came in with the results, and four people were waiting their results during that time period. During the testing bracket, 35 people came in under the haven't taken a test and will take one. Three people have elected to just strictly quarantine, 14 days, no testing. The other one on in that testing bracket's the 3C number, and that's the Alaska resident. Most of those people have just checked the 3A box, so they're kind of classified, grouped into that 3A number. We don't have anybody that's checked into that, but I know people have traveled that way. So they're grouped into that first box of 35. We've had four people come in that have been that are asymptomatic at this time, but have tested positive in the past 3 weeks prior to travel and are currently asymptomatic and have a note of recovery. And then we've had three people come in under the critical infrastructure / essential services who have checked that box anyways. Like I said, one positive test, and we've tested 25 people that have come back with vouchers and done their follow-up tests. So a real quick percentage wise of people that have come in that 72 hour with tests is about 70% of the people have come in that 72 hour window with tests or just waiting for the results. And then another 10% of those people have had negative results within 5 days. So a lot of people are coming in under that 72 hour window, which is really nice. I'll move on from that real fast. Search. I had a good conversation with Lisa today and following up on some stuff real quick. Search is applying for a grant to do asymptomatic testing on people. Lisa told me today that they're probably a couple weeks out from being able to release more information on that. They're still waiting to make sure that the grant is secured and finalized and how all of that will roll out before they even start talking too much about it. But they are looking at how that can happen and be done. Search on their website keeps putting that we have two cases on there. We really only have one. What that is that we've had two positive tests in our town, but that's the same case. They just followed up with a second test to make sure that it was indeed a positive. So it's, for some reason, that keeps happening, and we spent many hours making sure that that gets changed as quick as possible when that happens. I've had a few people email me and even today email me about Lisa feeling that they feel like she's been a little stressed out or overworked or feeling like she's stressed out or that she doesn't have the support from Search or the city. I called and we had a good talk today. Those rumors, she doesn't know where those are coming from or any of that. She told me that she doesn't feel stressed out or overworked. She said if she would have at this time, that would have been a few months ago when this all first came out and nobody really had too much, like Search didn't have their plans really set in stone. But she feels fairly comfortable with the Search plan at this time until something was really to happen or we didn't. And it got overloaded in Gus Davis or something, then, obviously she'll be asking for help. She said she will ask me for help as soon as she absolutely needs it. And then we can figure out how we can support the clinic at that time if we need to. So she's doing just good. And I check in over there quite often. So I will make sure that I follow up on that a lot more. Other than that, I don't really have much more that you guys haven't heard me say over the last few meetings, I believe. So if you guys have any questions on anything, because I know something's being talked about later, so I'll just let that happen. And you guys got questions, let me know. I'll try to answer them.
Okay, Susan, I see your hand up. Go ahead. You got a question for Travis?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Mayor. For Travis, out of curiosity, when a test is taken at the airport, it gets sent to CIRC and Sitka, and then where does it go? Thanks.
Thank you, Susan. We take the search or the samples here, just to like say how this really works. We take the samples here. It's a self-administered test. Monday through Thursday, those get shipped out on seaplanes. Monday through Thursday, they get shipped out on seaplanes and get done in Sitka. And they are done in their lab in Sitka. The Friday samples get shipped, they're processed in Juneau, I believe, is if I remember right off the top of my head, those ones get processed in Juneau. And then the ones that are taken Saturday get held Saturday and Sunday and then get shipped out Monday until they we can get them shipped to somewhere and then they get processed in Sitka once again. So most of our samples are getting done in Sitka. If Sitka gets overloaded, they would be shipped to Anchorage to be further tested at the state lab.
Susan, you had another question?
Yes, thank you. I'm in Juneau, and I met with some folks who are talking about trying to petition the state to develop a regional testing capability in Juneau. I would be interested in, it seems like there's been a lot of interest locally in upping our game in terms of testing. And if we had a regional testing facility in capacity in Juneau, it could bring our test results back at a much more rapid rate than having to ship them to Sitka and then on out. I would be interested in finding out if anybody on the council is interested in us doing a support resolution to the Juneau Assembly and to the chief medical officer and the state in support of the idea of developing a regional testing, Southeast regional testing capacity in Juneau. It wouldn't there would be no fiscal note to it, just developing a resolution in support of that idea. So I'm not sure where in tonight's meeting to bring that up, but I wanted to do it while we're talking about COVID.
It's actually not a bad idea, Susan. And lots of people, or this came up not too long ago, I think a month and a half ago, they started this process and it was out in the newspapers for a while too. So they've been working on this for a while. But during that time, most of the local hospitals have been able to process their own labs, like the Wrangell Hospital processes their own stuff and Petersburg will start processing their own stuff. So it's getting to be one of those tests too that can be processed more locally as long as you have that capability too. But I think it's a good idea. It was just hoping Search would buy off and want to send them there instead of just sending them to Sitka to their lab. But good idea.
Susan, I saw your hand go up, but can I ask another, make sure other council members get their questions in first. Any other council members? Okay, Susan, did you have one last question for us?
Yeah, thank you. I can try to work with Tom and see if I can come up with some kind of a support, a proposal for a resolution of support and see and float it past the council if other people are interested. Thanks.
Well, towards the end here, we need to talk about more COVID, more actions for COVID. Later on, there's on the last page of your work session packet was that list we started developing on our last work session, and based on some input from folks, and there's a further list development there, and so there's some more discussions on that to come here tonight. So if you want to hold on that, I imagine there might be some other resolutions as well that maybe we want to have staff work on related to COVID. Anyway, is there any other questions for Travis? Okay, just want to quickly go down our draft agenda for our regular business meeting next week. We have for approval, we've got minutes from our regular meeting on the 8th of June and our special meeting on the 15th of June. Those have all been circulated. If you have any corrections or additions to those, might want to bring them up now. So is there any additions or corrections that you guys notice? Okay, looks like minutes are ready to go. We'll have our regular committee staff reports. We'll have an update from Travis again. We'll have our public library report. And then also our treasurer's monthly financials. At this point, Phoebe, did you want to say anything about our financials? I know we have some good news you might want to share, Phoebe. So Phoebe, I'll let her speak here for a little bit. Go ahead, Phoebe.
Thanks, Mr. Mayor. We've got our financials for last fiscal year are kind of starting to gel. We have still a few more expenses that'll come through, and we're gonna we've got an NCO to transfer out the rest of the road maintenance funds, but we're looking at, it looks like just under $100,000 will be able to be rolled over from FY20. So we're in really good shape in that regards to support our FY21 budget deficit that we're starting with. I'll have the final, I'll have the numbers as final as they can be this week in the packet, and then they'll be when those last expenses come through that'll be applied to FY20. Those numbers will start finalizing, but we're looking good there. And then I also submitted to the state expenses, CARES Act expenses for March, April, and May. A week or two ago. I haven't heard anything back yet on those. And I submitted our first months of expenses for the airport screeners for June. And I'll be getting the June CARES expenses submitted this week also. But I'll be sending out the financial reports here in the packet later this week.
Okay, is there any questions for Phoebe? Okay, next we have Tom, and I think you had a few items for us to think about tonight as well. And
all right, thank you, Mayor. Good evening. So I sent out some documents last week concerning our CARES Act funding. We had a draft application, a draft economic assistance information sheet, and some proposed procedures for how we want to process our grants. The documents are draft. They're basically, the contents have been run past the city attorney, but I'll want to give him the final documents and make sure that all of our information is correct. In my research, I found some conflicting information on, for example, what is an eligible expense, or some of the more common procedural processes, like how to determine what a small business might be able to receive in terms of calculating the amounts. So I want to run those by the city attorney after we complete the smooth drafts. So tonight I was hoping to get some direction on how the council feels in terms of the application. Primarily areas like how we want to fund them. So unless there's questions on the application or the economic assistance information sheet, I thought we could go to the procedures, and that should help answer a lot of those questions. Are there any questions on the application or the information sheet that we could go over first, or are we ready to go into procedures?
Okay, council members, got any questions on the application before we go on to procedures?
We can mix them in as well if we have a question on procedures and we need to cross-reference to one of the other forms.
Okay, that sounds good. Why don't you go ahead and proceed?
Okay. So we have approximately 91 small businesses and nonprofits that potentially could file for a grant. So if we're looking at a program that is open to basically all of those, we should talk about how we want to award that grant and how we want to determine the amount. So one of the proposals for determining how we would figure out the businesses and the amounts would be putting together a review group. So I put out two possible options. One was a staff option, with myself, the treasurer, and the fire chief to review the grants and determine which ones meet the criteria for locally owned and operated. We could review the applications and go over the line item expenses to make sure they're consistent and compliant with the CARES Act funding intent. Then we would be able to submit those selected applications to the mayor for approval and then provide a report to the council on you know, which applications were approved and for what amount. The other review team concept was having two or three council members with or without staff to basically do the same thing. Review the grants, determine which ones are eligible, look at what they're proposing the use of the funds for, and then submit to the mayor for approval. Is there any thought on how the council feels about how we would review the applications? Okay, I'll work through there. If any other questions pop up, we can go ahead and revisit those. And then a little trick.
Hold on, I got Mike. Hold on.
Okay.
I had a question from Mike.
yes, thank you, Mr. Mayor and City Administrator. I like the staff option, although if there was a council member that wanted to join that staff group, that might be helpful, but I really like the, I think this is a good administrative process to do, and I think the staff option is fine without trying to make a committee out of a bunch of council members.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. That's what I was thinking. We would be following these. I'm sorry, did I interrupt?
Well, Susan had her hand up. I wanted to make sure she had a chance as well before you. That was more of a support from Mike from the idea of having a mixture of the two options. Go ahead. Go ahead, Susan.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I would see a mix because having staff review applications for eligibility is one thing, but awarding funding, in my mind, is a council function, not a staff function. So it would be really important to have council on the decisions about awarding funding. Thank you.
Okay, so if there's council members who want to be part of the review team, maybe they could just submit to the mayor, and the mayor can select some folks to work with us in reviewing the applications.
Sounds good to me. If council members, if you're interested in serving on this committee, go ahead and send me an email, and we'll, as long as there's, I guess three is free. So if you're interested. Okay, go ahead, Tom.
So the trickier part is going to be determining the amount. So the application did not include a section that talks about using the total income as a metric for determining amount of award. And I put it in both the procedural and in the economic assistance information sheet so that the council could see what it would look like as a proposed process. So as you can see here with how to determine amount of grant award, we use $1 million of total income as a cap because that's the definition of small business, as you can see there. So if we're looking at nonprofits and small businesses, we already have determined a residency process of determination. We want to talk about how we would award the money. So there was a couple of options. One was a flat rate. Each applicant would get a certain amount of money based on the potential of all small businesses applying. You could determine that fixed rate based on the 91, whatever that actual number is. Or we could look at it in terms of total income and then determine a percentage of that for the funding. As I put in as an example, for the procedural sheet, it just seemed to me it was a little lopsided if a business with lots of employees and a high total revenue income amount got the same amount as a small business with one or two employees and a low total income amount. But that is an option. Another option would be to take their total income and determine a percentage of the funds that would go to that business with a not to exceed amount. An example I gave there is we could give 25% of total income not to exceed $20,000. That would be a combination of using a total income metric and a first-come, first-served approach. If we were to assume that multiple people would be applying, we would max out at 20,000 per application, we'd hit that $150,000 threshold then before all applicants could get in. So that's kind of the trickier part of that. If you scroll, as you scroll down, you can see some of the metric ranges that some other communities are using, and then figure out what percentage or what amount would go into that highlighted area. So this one, this one's a little more difficult. I'm looking for some input from the council on how you want to do that. There's some options on how we do it. We could talk about it now. We could use a flat rate amount. We could put together a review team and work into the details further on how to determine amount of awards. We would want to do that in the very near future, since there is a timeline on the use of these funds. So I'm looking for some input, please.
Susan, did you have something?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Mayor. Am I missing something? We decided to allocate $150,000. And if we have 91 small businesses and nonprofits, that would be $1,648.35 each. I'm not following where all of these factors are coming in. So help me with that.
Okay, thanks, Susan. So that's the flat rate amount, right? We, you know, each business get about $1,000. My thought was that dividing that money up that way might seem unfair to some, that a business with multiple employees, say 20 employees, and a total income of, you know, $600,000, $500,000, gets the same amount as a two or three employee business that total income is less than $100,000. I'm fine either way. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying one's better than the other. That's why the application didn't include this, but I wanted to be able to provide the council with another approach in case anyone else had concerns about a flat rate approach. So that's why there's the two ways of doing it and why I was looking for input. If we're fine with the flat rate, that makes it simpler for the review team in determining how much each applicant would get. And then at the end, if only 50 applicants applied, they would still only get the $1,000. Now, I suppose we could do another round and see if there's any more late applicants, or just keep that funding available until the end of the year. But that's one way we could do it, and it would be simpler, I think, to follow that approach. Thank you.
Okay, Mike. Mike Taylor, go ahead. You were.
I guess I don't think that this program ought to just be an outright gift of cash, although you can make the case for that, that it would be put to use by the business owners generally as they saw fit. I'd rather that we were spending or allocating money according to the need. And I also wouldn't base it on the size of the business. I think it's a matter of what their application says they need it for and use it for, and particularly whether it's to offset COVID-related costs or losses. And So I don't like the idea of necessarily giving a bigger business more money. There may be a smaller business needs it more than the bigger one. So I know that's a lot tougher, but that really falls back to the review team making a decision, as tough as it's going to be, as to how to allocate the money. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. So there's more to it, and I just assumed that, you know, that was already understood. So these are all, we're going to issue these grants, and then we have to file a report with the state on the money that we spent. So if we issue a grant to a business and the state rejects that in our report, we're eating that money. So we need to be sure that the grant that we issue complies with the eligibility of the CARES Act program. So the proposal is, when somebody submits a grant application, that they have a line item of how they're going to use those funds, so that they're not using it for something not permitted by CARES Act. Does that help understand a little bit more on a business not being able to use the money for just anything? It has to be for, remember that the purpose is economic injury. And that's the term that's in the language for the CARES Act eligibility. So we have to demonstrate that the grant is fulfilling resolution to this economic injury. And that's why
thanks, yeah, that, the list that of answers eligible, my concern.
Awesome. Okay. Thanks. So what I'm hearing is we might want to go with the flat rate amount. So if the council's okay with it, I'll go ahead and clean up the grant application and the information sheet. I'll put those little boxes of the application so that they reflect the flat rate approach. It won't have any of the language about total income or ranges for eligibility. If the council wants to change that, you know, we could talk about it at the general meeting, or even come up with another grant program down the road. Does that sound viable to the council?
Mike, you had something?
Yeah, sorry, a couple more questions. Not all 63 businesses probably are going to submit grants, so grant applications. So are you going to wait? Would you wait a certain amount of time to see how many businesses you're actually going to spread this over and then send the money out? That could be quite a bit later. I'm still concerned about the flat rate approach. It may not be enough for some businesses that really have a serious need, and it may be more than others need. So if I'd kind of rather see the committee decide what each applicant gets based on their application. And even then, you're probably going to have to wait till you get enough of them in so you can think about how you're going to sort through $150 or $150,000 over those, say, several dozen applications that you might get. I hope that makes a little.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. I think I understand maybe a little bit better. So if we have $150,000, if we take your approach and we're going to have people submit their applications And we're not going to have any metric in terms of how much each applicant gets, that the review committee will provide funding, similar like you do for the endowment grant. We have a limit, and then you submit a project and we fund in full or in part. If you want to take that approach, then we would be able to fund applications until money runs out. And the only concern would be that businesses understand that they have to have spent the money by the end of the year. So practically, if they haven't submitted an application by November, it's going to be difficult to get it processed, get the money, spend the money by the end of the year. But that's entirely possible. So that would be the approach. We would have the money available until it's all gone. Review each application, the team would review each application, fund in full or in part based on the merits of that application, and then do that until we have exhausted all the funding. Does that sound right, Mike?
Yes, that does sound right. I think that's the best way to do it, but I admit it's a lot more work for the committee, but I appreciate those who are willing to do it. And I think that'll make the best use of the money for the community.
Susan, you had a comment, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm kind of horrified by that approach. I mean, if we don't treat everybody the same, and then that means that every single decision is liable for adjudication. And we're gonna have to be able to defend every single decision about who gets how much money if people don't get the same. So we're talking about $1,648, adding all of this staff overhead about decision making and targeting and all that kind of stuff. Is it really worth it? I mean, is there any sole proprietor business that hasn't been injured by $1,648 and with the loss of tourism? I mean, come on, let's spend our staff time on stuff that is really critical. I'm horrified by that approach, and I would really vote for just treating everybody the same.
Joe Vanderzan, go ahead.
Yeah, I was looking at the bottom of that page you have posted. I think the to provide up to a certain percentage of total income, not to exceed a certain amount. To me, right now, that makes the most sense and simplest for the committee.
Okay, other council members on a preference, whether we're going to do a flat rate like Susan Warner was suggesting, or are we going to do something different like Mike was suggesting, or go with the suggestion at the end of what's on the screen, kind of like what Joe was suggesting. So I guess that there's three options of how to go. Is there any preference from council members we haven't heard from yet? Go ahead, Brittany.
Thank you. I believe that I would like to see us also go with the flat rate. So I agree with Susan. Thanks.
Any other council members want to speak up on this one? Joe Clark, go ahead.
I think that the total percentage of income would be the best and fairest way to allocate the funds, because some people will be hurt a lot and some will be hurt very little. So my two bits.
Shelley, I haven't heard from you on this. Did you have an opinion one way or the other on the way to go this? Council members, anybody who hasn't spoken on the preference of which way to go on this, do you want to say anything? Go ahead, Joe Clark.
I'm kind of at a loss why we need a committee to review these applications as they come in. And they are verified and looked over and either approved or disapproved. Seems to me like it's kind of a just a bookkeeping situation. We don't want to, I hate to say just catch somebody in a lie or something like that, but if everything looks legitimate on the application to move forward with approval or disapproval. Why we need a committee for that, I just don't, I think it's just too much oversight. I don't know.
Well, yeah, Joe, I think you're right. If we're talking, like you were saying, if we're talking a flat rate methodology like if we do a flat rate methodology, yeah, we don't have as much committee work on it. It's just staff time making sure that, you know, they had a business license, that they operated, and that they met the basic qualifications. And then, you know, the money is, like you said, it's a flat rate. So, yeah, I don't anticipate a flat rate system taking a lot of staff time or committee time. I think if we are to take do a percentage of income, or if we're going to evaluate each application, decide how much money to give each applicant. Yeah, that does take a lot more staff time, takes a lot more committee work. Mike, I see your hand up. Go ahead.
I think one thing the committee's got to do is decide whether the applicant is applying for things that are likely to be allowable. And they may, suppose an applicant asks for money for five different things, and maybe two or three of them are questionable. The committee is going to still have to evaluate all those things and decide whether they are likely to be reimbursable, because the city's going to have some real risk here if we aren't really careful about what we approve funding for. It's got to be for stuff that we're pretty confident is going to be reimbursable, or we're stuck with it.
If I could add to that, if an application comes in and it looks like it's an allowable expense, but maybe just needs better write-up of that item, I would work that application to make sure that it had some of those key terms like the economic injury, to ensure that it's following the purpose of the CARES Act funding. If somebody's asking, you know, purchase a new skiff to go, fishing on, without any reference to how that's helping economic recovery, I would contact that applicant and say, well, we need to make this relatable to CARES Act funding. that is economic injury, how is this helping your business recover? And if we can't get to a good description of how that item is helping, then that item wouldn't be an eligible expense, or it would have high risk. And then, you know, it possibly could go to the mayor, who's going to review all these for approval and, you know, be marked or identified as a item of the request that we're not recommending approving funding for. If that means having a council member on there to help with that determination, or multiple council members, that's fine. But that's how the process would work. I don't see this as the applications coming in and not working with those applicants to improve their application so that they could get approved. It could just simply be that the person writing it up doesn't have the practice of putting an application together that would have the clarity for qualifying for the grant. I hope that helped.
Okay, any other council comments? All right, Tom, I guess, do you have enough to go on, or do we still need to determine how we're going to do?
I think we're good. I appreciate all the input. So what I got from this is council members who are interested in being part of the team are going to submit their names to you, and then you would appoint council members to work with the treasurer, the fire chief, and myself in doing reviews and submitting recommended approvals to you. And we're going to use a flat rate approach. And the way that's going to work is every business is going to be eligible for around $1,000. If there's a remainder at the end of the year, then what we'll have is a contingency expenditure list of that we could submit on short notice for additional CARES Act items. Does that sound right?
Joe Van Der Zanden, go ahead.
Yeah, did we settle on flat rate? I don't have a good example or experience in what businesses are like here, but a business license, as I remember, is pretty cheap. And for people to stay legal, you know, they might have a hobby that's a business that might only make $1,000 a year, but they're happy to do it and they don't mind paying the $25 or whatever it is for a license. And you know, this amount that they're awarded, it's possible it could equal their whole year's income. And I guess that's partly why I was, I thought it was more equitable to do a percentage of total income. Thanks.
Yep. Thanks, Jill. The reason I said flat rate is because I heard two council members like the flat rate idea, and then there was you, and then there was Mike. So I guess, Mayor, I'm fine with any of the ways we want to do it. I just kind of need to know which way.
Well, I kind of prefer a percentage of income as well, just because you have to scale it to the size of the business, kind of like what Joe was, Joe Van Der Zand was saying. You know, I understand the concern about treating everybody the same, but I don't know, it just seems like that necessarily wouldn't be treating everybody fairly. Anyway, I'm open. I mean, it doesn't sound like there's a whole lot of consensus on which way to go on this. I mean, do people want to think about this some more? Or, I mean, I don't know how much longer we can think about it, because we need to get this money out to folks. Instead of giving it to businesses, maybe we give it to every PFD address in the city or something. I don't know. Go ahead, Joe Clark.
Are we opening up ourselves to litigation if we go with the percentage program number three, or would we be better served to go with the flat rate just to avoid litigation which is safest for the city?
If I could say something, Mayor, as far as Joe's question, it's not so much how we decide who gets and how much they get. It's if it met the intent of the CARES Act funding. So a flat rate could be just as risky as a percentage rate. The other thing we have to recognize is it's not just small business, it's also nonprofits. So nonprofits don't necessarily have a total income. Take, for example, the community center who may have incurred economic injury, but had not opened yet and was damaged economically by the pandemic. We would have a difficult time meeting that criteria if we wanted to fund them under a percentage base versus a flat rate base. So a nonprofit may be at somewhat of a disadvantage or a challenge if we're doing it based on total income. I don't know if that helps or just complicates things, but just wanted to clarify that. Thanks.
Okay, I saw Susan first, so Susan, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Yeah, I'm just having trouble with the math. So if we have $150,000, how many people can we give up to $20,000 to before we run out of $150,000? I can't figure out how anything other than a flat allocation of $1,635 is going to be distributed and allow all the businesses in Gustavus to benefit. So that's where I'm getting stuck.
Mike, go ahead.
That $1,635 depends really on how many applications you have. You know, not necessarily all those 63 businesses are going to have a coverable expense. Not necessarily. Some may just choose not to apply at all, or they don't want to bother, or they don't think they've got any justifiable thing to claim. The other question I've got is, what do you do if a person has more than one small business? Some people operate, you know, several. Do they get a grant on each one of those? How do you handle that?
Okay, so that's in the information sheet that talks about owners with multiple businesses. I think if we're if we're going to go into areas where we're, if we're talking about each business getting a certain amount, then a multiple business operator could receive multiple checks, unless we had criteria that identify limitations, like the sole proprietors and you know, seasonal businesses and that kind of thing. So if you go to, let's see what page this is, page 7 of the information sheet, one of the questions is, I own multiple businesses. Can each of my businesses receive a separate award? The answer is no. If you own a majority interest in more than one business, then only one of those businesses would receive an award. If an individual owns a minority interest in multiple businesses, each business is eligible. So if I own 4 businesses, I get 1. If I'm part owner in multiple businesses, then I could be eligible for multiple checks.
Joe Clark, go ahead.
Yes, if we were to consider option 3, the total income and then a percentage not to exceed $20,000, is there any reason we can't lower that, say, by 50%, you know, $10,000? Would the math work better then?
Well, it's a not to exceed, so we can fund anything, whether it's $10,000 or you know, 5,000, we would have a ceiling. If we took Mike's scenario where, say, 50 businesses apply, and so there was $50,000 spent, what would we do with that extra money? Well, we could allow for a second filing. So people who submitted projects up to $1,000 or $1,500 could then submit for another project for $1,000 or $1,500 until the money was spent. So we could do a second issuance of funding under a flat rate approach as well. Thanks.
Okay, Joe VanderZanden, you're next.
Yeah, you caught my interest when you mentioned every PFD address in town. I was just wondering if we could do that like Skagway did. If we say had 400 people apply, that would be close to $400 per applicant, and that might help the local businesses just as much as if they each got a little cut of the thing anyway. A lot of food for thought there.
That's a great idea, Joe. And another out of the box one would be taking the money and putting it, you know, with the power company and applying it to, you know, individuals' utility bills. That's another approved expense. There's been several really good examples of how to use the funds besides taking a grant approach and using the PFD as verification of residency would make it fairly easy to defend. So that's a good suggestion too, Joe.
Joe Clark, go ahead.
Is there any chance we could take a straw poll of the council as to how, you know, option number 1 or flat rate or the option number 2, the percentage rate, and see how the council falls on that so that Tom has a way to proceed?
So you're giving us direction, Joe? It's not a vote. I'm looking for direction. So, in order to, if we were in the City Hall, I would be looking at you and looking for you to raise your hand if you like one or the other. This is very similar, except you're doing it vocally. So I think if the mayor wanted to ask, you know, how many people wanted to do flat rate, you know, they could answer and we would be fine there.
Okay, thank you for that clarification.
Okay, Brittany, I saw your hand.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. On the note that Joe Van Der Zanden brought up about giving money just to PFD to the residents, Whitney Rapp just sent me a really good piece of information from the city of Metlakatla that they've been like a stipend that they've given to the residents. So if that was something we wanted to explore a little bit further, I could pass that along to the
Okay, Joe Van Der Zanden, and I saw you first. Go ahead.
I think we should explore that further. Also, I thought that if we went that route, that people should apply for it like they do regular permanent fund. And I think the figure would be somewhere around $400, and that would include kids. If it went to the utility company, that would only be a household, but it wouldn't be quite as equitable for the whole town.
Susan, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Yeah, I'm trying to sort out, okay, people who are recommending a percentage of the business, you're intentionally not including many of the smaller businesses in Gustavus because that $150,000 will get vacuumed up by the larger businesses. So you're intentionally not allowing all businesses to participate if because there's not enough money to do that. And then on the individual allocation, I know that like some people have done that. I think Skagway's passed out checks, but I thought that the purpose of the CARES Act funding money was to help existing businesses stay open and recover from financial impact from COVID-19. Is it better to just give everybody, you know, have them apply for an additional PFD check and that somehow is going to keep our businesses from closing, leaving, or going out of business? Or is, you know, so shouldn't we be spending the money on what it was intended to be spent on, which is helping small businesses recover from the financial impact of not having tourism? Thanks.
If I could comment on that, we
go ahead, Tom, then I'll go to Mike.
I was just going to suggest we could maybe do a voucher system that would require spending the money in town with local businesses versus, you know, just cutting a check and letting the money migrate. That would be one option. That's all I had.
Yeah, I agree with Susan's comment there. I think this portion of the funding is intended to keep businesses afloat and not for another distribution to people. We are getting or have had a distribution and may get more distribution from the federal government in the future on this thing. And I think we need to use this money as well as we can to prop up our local businesses to offset the issues they've had due to COVID. So I would stick with that, we can. And I still like the idea of basing what they get on what their need really is and what they're going to use it for. But it sounds like I'm the only one.
Joe Clark, go ahead.
After listening to everyone, I kind of support Susan's idea of a flat rate. I think it will be less complicated and fair at the same time. That's my two bits.
Okay, it sounds like flat rate then, Tom.
All righty. So flat rate, and if you could notify the mayor no later than Thursday, if you want to be part of the team, I'll try to go ahead and have something firmed up by the weekend so that it'll be available for Monday night. Any other questions on the first star?
Doesn't look like it, Tom, go ahead.
Awesome, okay. So the second star has to do with a couple of requests that have come in recently for funding. They don't fit into the discussion of small businesses. So I'm looking for direction. Council member Vander Zanden had a suggestion for testing. I sent that out to everybody for council members and Vander Zanden. And I had some questions about that, and I asked Travis, and his responses were in the red. I don't see this. It's on the second page. So I'm looking to see how folks feel about funding a project as suggested by Councilmember Vander Zanden. It could be additional category, and we could work the details out if the council is interested in taking on this project. So I'm looking for some input.
Council members, any input for Tom on Joe Vander Zanden's suggestion for go ahead, Mike.
I think Joe's got a great idea here. More testing in the community is good. We could design a program where we use pool testing even, which is something that the state is now giving thought to. And I had an exchange with Dr. Zink on that, and she's gonna get back to me with what they're thinking about how we could use pool testing here in Gustavus. Since we have either a very low or zero rate of infection here, we could test groups in pools as a way of finding, of quickly identifying whether we actually have exposed, whether we have the virus in the community. And that would save us a lot of money on the analysis, because you would do one analysis for the whole pool. And only if the pool showed that there, if the pool sample showed COVID virus, then we would retest that pool only. But that's, I would like to see a lot more testing done in the community as a way of identifying more quickly when, if we have a case of the virus in the community. So I'm all for this, and I would support using whatever amount of CARES Act we need to do to.
Joe Clark, go ahead.
I think Joe van der Zanden's idea is an excellent one. The more testing we can have in the community, the better off we're going to be. And it's a good idea.
Joe van der Zanden, go ahead.
Yeah, when I suggested that, I was only thinking of a few people in town that are high exposure. They're in contact with a lot of the public most days, like at the store, the coffee shop, some that I'm missing. But my suggestion was that their employers would pick the ones that were at risk the most and have them tested every week or two, just to cut down on the risk of that. I know Lisa is kind of holding out for search to possibly test the whole community, but Travis told me that's you know, that's pretty short term. You never know from one week to the next what could be going on. But if someone was asymptomatic and had a high exposure to the public, that seemed to me a dangerous situation and a good place to spend a little bit of testing money.
Shelley Owens, go ahead. Shelley Owens, did you have something? Okay, Joe Clark, your hand is up.
Yes, it sounds to me like Joe is suggesting a more targeted testing at high-risk groups. I'm for that also, and I think, you know, I really worry about Lisa, I'll tell you that, and the people who work behind the counter at the Toshco and the people who work at the post office. I think if we can get the whole town tested, that would be a great thing too. The testing is something that it gives us a lot more knowledge about this virus. So that's my two bits.
Mike Taylor, go ahead.
Yeah, I wonder if Shelley's mic or if her computer mic isn't on or something. That's why we maybe haven't heard from her. Our sampling strategy could and should indeed focus on the highest risk locations first. So that would be, you know, obviously places like Toshco, and you'd want to do the staff, you know, maybe every 2 weeks or so. So you'd focus on those number one, but it could be expanded to do the whole community. And again, the pool sampling method or pool analysis method cuts the cost of analysis. So you can do a pool sample on up to 20 samples, and for one analysis. So presumably something like that 175 or whatever is the cost of doing an analysis could cover, could check 20 people if you pool the samples. So we should do that first for groups or locations that have a lot of contact with the public and possibility of getting infected. We could also use that for the crew at the airport. They're being tested every 2 weeks, and you could pool samples there for a single analysis and save money on that if it was any benefit to the.
I'm going to try again for Shelley. Shelley, did you have something?
Mr. Mayor, I just got a text from Shelley saying my audio output isn't working. I support community testing as well as businesses. Also airport workers, ? Really like pool testing. That's what she said. So apparently she's got a problem with her audio. Output the speaker.
Joe Vanderzand, go ahead.
I just had a question about this pool testing, which I hadn't heard of before. Is that where they would test, say, 20 people and expect that they would all come out negative, but one was positive, back to retest to find out who it was?
Mr. Mayor, if I may, yes, that's correct. This was suggested about 2 weeks ago, I think, first by Dr. Fauci, and I just asked the state about it, actually on the 4th of July, and got back an answer on the 4th of July from Dr. Zink, saying they are already considering that. So yes, it works for populations that have low expectation of a positive sample. Obviously, if you've got more than, say, 5% or so, you might as well just analyze every one, because probably every pool is going to have one positive person in it, and then you have to resample everybody. So you do it for populations like Gustavus that are expected, it's expected that the vast majority of pools will not have anybody positive in them. And then you just resample the pool if you get a positive for that pool, and you only do it for that group.
Thanks, Mike.
Well, I think, Tom, maybe if you can, maybe work with Travis, and sounds like Mike has been talking with folks as well, and maybe come up with a proposal that the council can consider, or something that we can consider to think about, maybe put in place. Sounds like we still have to have some more discussions with CERCH and DHSS just on the how that testing, the logistics of how that testing would occur. But maybe if you guys can staff that out a bit more and come back with something else for us to, but it sounds like everybody's on board with trying to come up with a better testing protocol.
Okay, so what I'm hearing is that we're going to look at what it would cost to do testing for targeted group, and then also a program where we would do pool testing, so that we would have an idea of a pot of money that would need to be dedicated for this project. In addition, we would need to check with our clinic and understand what implications a project of either of those approaches would have on the clinic, and whether or not that's something they could do, if we would need to get additional assistance, et cetera. Am I understanding that correctly, Mayor?
Yep, right on. That's exactly right. Yep.
Okay, terrific. I know Travis is listening, so I'll work with him tomorrow and we'll start drafting something up and hopefully have something for the general meeting. Thank you. The other request comes from the Chatham School District. As you can see there, the school district is looking for around $16,500 for those bulleted items above. This funding would be for the Gustavus School because CARES Act is for the community and the school is in our community, and therefore these items would have to be for the Gustavus School. I understand the superintendent is online tonight. If any council members had questions about this request, otherwise I'm looking for direction on whether or not the council would like to fund this request or a reduced amount or get additional information. Thank you.
Well, since we have the superintendent online, is there any questions for him from council members? Susan, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Mr. Superintendent, it's my understanding that President Trump has stated that he's intending specifically to allocate additional monies in a future COVID funding to help reopen schools. Are you not expecting that source of funding to come through, and so are asking to tap into the city CARES funds? Thank you.
Mr. Haupt, can you respond? Are you online?
Well, perhaps he wasn't able to join us this evening. Would the council like me to hold this item for the general meeting and contact the superintendent again to ask him to join us for the general meeting?
Well, I really don't have a problem funding them for this. President Trump may promise a lot of things and say he's going to do a lot of things, but I don't think we should be counting on any of that. It takes more than just the president to pass a piece of legislation. Everybody knows that. It takes Congress to go along with it. I think the need for our kids to be safe at school is more important, and that we should just pay for it and just go ahead and give them this money. I don't want to have to send the school to, or basically say, well, wait and see what happens in a couple months to see if something comes through. I don't think we should have to do that. We have plenty of money. We should be able to take care of this for our school and the kids that go to it. Mike, go ahead.
Yeah, Cal, I agree with you 100% on that. Getting the kids back in school is a very important thing for the kids, for their development, for the economy. But for it to work, the staff and the parents and the kids all have to be assured that there's safety at the school, that the school can be restarted safely. And these items are essential to that. What's more, they'll actually be beneficial in preventing flu in the future, or even this winter, combating flu if we didn't have a COVID issue. So I think there's a lot of value to this. It's essential to get the kids back in school as soon as possible. And this is the least that we can do.
Brittany, go ahead.
Thank you. I also feel good about funding this. I think all of you know that I also work at the school and would doubly like to see us support the school as much as possible. I know a lot of parents are obviously concerned. So whatever the council or whatever the city can do to help, I think we should.
Any other council comment? Joe Clark, go ahead.
I know this is a worthy deal, but it's $16,500. Is that the amount asked for? And would Phoebe have something to say about, do we have, you said in your statement that we have the money, but do we really have the money?
Okay, Phoebe's going to answer.
I'm sorry. We did receive our first installment of $381,000.
Okay, then I'm good to go on.
This is the spreadsheet we have from where we left off. At the work session at the end of June. And so we've received this $381,000 so far. I haven't updated our June expenditure here yet, but this 33 grand was submitted to the state already and we paid GVA. If we add this $16,500 in, we'd be at $287 so far out of that first payment.
Thank you, Phoebe.
Susan, did you have something?
Just quick question for Phoebe. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Phoebe, did you send the spreadsheet to us? Would you do that? I know it's a work in progress, but it would help me a lot. Thanks.
She's nodding her head. She'll get that out. Okay, any other council comment on the $16,000 in the $16,500 for the school. Susan, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Yes, I do agree with our other council members. Getting the school open is really critical to our community and our parents and our employees and all of that. Have we reviewed the school reopen plan, and do we have an involvement with that? Are we granting these supplies money with a known date of reopen? Sorry, I might have gotten that and didn't see it.
I can answer that, Mayor. The school did forward their reopening plan. I sent that out to the council. As I understand it, the intent is to, as long as we're at low risk, which is where we are today, they're going to open on the normal timeline. They do have procedures for classroom configuration and participation and all that internal stuff. But it's my understanding that they are going to open as usual. I received two comments back on their plan. Both were in support or had no objection or other comment to their plan. Okay, Mayor, so it sounds like I'll notify the superintendent and let him know that we're going to fund his request and give him all the particulars in terms of providing the line item and ensuring the expenses of Fergus Davis, all the things I mentioned tonight. Does that sound right?
Excellent. Sounds great, Tom. Sounds great.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions on CARES Act before I move down to the library roof?
Doesn't look like it. Let's move.
All righty. So, the library roof, we're trying to find a solution to getting the work done to the roof before it gets to a point where we have to have work done to the roof. Our previous attempts to have a project that pulled back the roof, replaced the panels, and inspected for further damage have been unsuccessful. Different thoughts on why that is. As a guess, I offer that contractors are finding $40,000 a risky proposition, in that there's no commitment to fund additional work if that was found. So as an alternative, I was thinking we could reverse the process and fund a larger amount, as an example, $150,000, and have it follow a similar process as they go through the removal of the roof and determining the extent of the damage. If they find that it's only to the sills and the, as the original project suggested it might be, then we would end there. However, if they found that additional damage was there, they would be able to provide the city a report on what that additional damage would be, and be able to give a more accurate scope of work proposal and have the confidence that the funding's already in place so that their time would not be wasted in doing that work. That was a suggestion to see if maybe we couldn't get a response to the project. And I know it's an additional commitment of funding. Clearly it's larger than what was previously authorized, and we'd have to go through the process of doing that, of getting the funds through the CIP process. But I'm looking for some feedback from the council on whether or not they're interested in trying this approach, or if they have other suggestions. Thank you.
Mike Taylor, go ahead. Saw your hand go up.
Yeah, I think part of the problem we've had is the uncertainty about what the project is going to be. And so that's made it really hard for anybody to bid. And we put it out, tried it a couple of times. Maybe if we still have to select a contractor, we do it with a request for proposal rather than an outright flat bid. And we asked them to propose what they would do, and it would be on a time and material basis. We would monitor the project closely as they saw as they get the roof open and really see what's needed. Then they could ask us or propose what they want to do with it at that point, and we approve it piece by piece as they go forward. And I think, yeah, it will help to have a lot more money available just in case we need it. But I think letting them work it on a time and material basis, if they're a qualified contractor, that might be the best that we can do. Thanks.
Any other comment on the library roof?
Thanks, Mike, for that. So what we'll do is we'll start with the process for the CIP, get that generated so that we can have the funds identified, and then work on an RFP, and then hopefully we can get that out with some time available this calendar year, maybe to get the project started, or if not, we can carry that over, and hopefully the roof will last until next spring. Does that sound like a good approach, Mayor?
Yep, that sounds good. It sounds like the way forward.
Okay, well, thanks very much to all of you for the input on these subjects. They were a little bit tenacious. Appreciate all the input. If there's any other questions, I'd be happy to address those.
Okay, we're working through our business meeting agenda. We're going to talk about the next few things on our proposed agenda. It's under the consent agenda. I think Phoebe wanted to handle this one. The first one, that's CY 2018 Endowment Fund Asset Allocation Plan. So go ahead, Phoebe.
So this is something we do every fiscal year, and it's reviewing how our endowment fund is invested. The Alaska Permanent Capital Management up in Anchorage manages our account. And so I asked them in May to look at our previous year's allocation, which is what is shown here, and see if they had any input on changing it or kind of where we were sitting. They sent back a nice PowerPoint, which was in the packet here, which hopefully you've had a chance to look at. I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but I wanted to scroll down. Tom and I had a teleconference, a video conference with them on Thursday about some of the high points in this packet they gave us. And so I just wanted to go over those with you really quickly. Actually, we'll just go to the very end here first to start and then go backwards. The main thing for the council to consider at this point is that we currently are set up, we're seeking a 3% distribution rate. This is what is funding our endowment fund grant program that we pull funds out of each year. And we can no longer maintain a 3% distribution rate with our current risk level that we are at. And so the council needs to decide if it is more important to stay at our current risk level or if it is more important to try to seek the 3% or maintain the 3% distribution rate with slightly increased risk. Our investment advisors talked to us about it, and the bottom line kind of is that if they had a new business walk in today that wanted to invest with them, they would be giving them these new new allocations that they are suggesting to us if we wanted to maintain our 3% distribution. So things have just changed with the pandemic, and so with that, the council just needs to make a decision. If we maintain our current risk tolerance level, the expected distribution rate would be 2%. And if you look along the bottom here of page 48, you can see with our current risk what the endowment fund grant allocations might look like over the coming years. They've been in the 40,000 plus range in recent years, and instead we would be looking more at the 29 to 30 thousand dollar range for the next several years under the current risk level. If we took a slightly increased risk to try to maintain that 3% distribution rate, this bottom row shows us maintaining kind of where we've been at with the endowment fund grant. So it seemed my takeaway from the call, and Tom can chime in if I'm misquoting him at all, but was that this is the new customers that would be presenting with this 3%, the same kind of risk that we would be taking with this 3% distribution rate, trying to maintain that. So it's just up to the council whether they're comfortable with slightly increased risk or maintain the current 3% distribution, or if it's more important to stay at the current risk level, which would yield likely a 2% distribution rate.
Joe Vanderzen.
Yeah, Phoebe, if you were to switch to the 2%, are we locked into that for a long time, or do we get to look at this again in another year, see if things are a little bit back to normal?
Thanks, Joe. That's a good question. We would be looking at this again. This is just set up for a year at a time is how it's currently. We've done it a year and a half. Sometimes we've done it mid-year, but it's a year at a time. So we would be doing the same. We would talk to them again in May of next year and do the same exercise. And we could do it sooner if we wanted also. But these are set up usually for the whole fiscal year. So it would be reanalyzed next spring.
Susan, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Yes, I would be in favor of keeping our risk level the same and reducing the distribution rate for this next year. until we see where we are next year. It was kind of in the back of my mind of wondering whether we should be awarding any endowment fund grants this year and instead hang on to the money or apply it to the city's deficit. So I would be in favor of keeping the risk level the same and reducing the distribution for this year to the 2%. Thank you.
Mike Taylor, go ahead.
Guess I'll have to disagree with Susan on this one. If we were to check our inflation corrected principle, we have actually quite a bit. We're quite a bit above what we originally had for principle, even with the distributions we're making. I would go with the slightly riskier opportunity to make some more money. Over time, we will make money. We could have a little more volatility, might go up and down a little more each year, but over time, we're not going to lose it, in my view. So I would accept their advice and go for the enough so that we could hope to give out 3%. If we find that that it's gone way down and we don't want to give anything that year, the council can make that decision. Thanks.
If I might mention something too, Tom reminded me that I don't think we could use it for our budget deficit. We'd have to really look at those funds have very specific uses that they're allowed to be used for out of the endowment fund. So I don't have that right in front of me, but I don't know that would be an allowable expense or would take some work.
This Mike, that's correct as far as I know.
Joe Clark, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I think we should keep the risk level the same and evaluate it in the future. Phoebe said we can do it at any time, if I heard her right, but it's usually done in the spring. But if the conditions change, we can look at it in the future. So I say let's keep it the same.
Excuse me, Joe, keep it the same. You mean keep our distribution the same at 3%?
Yes, keep the risk level the same. 3%.
Okay. Right now we have a 3% distribution and if we were to take the same amount of risk, basically to have the same amount of distribution of 3%, we have to take more risk. So if we keep the risk the same, then we're going to have a 2% distribution. So that's the question. That's the question that Phoebe was asking.
Okay, then I'll restate it. I'm willing to go back to the 2%.
Okay, Susan.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I was taking a shortcut. I'm sorry, I shouldn't do that. When I said use the endowment fund to offset city deficit spending, as I recall, the library or DRC is able to fund some special projects for them through the endowment fund. So those might be funds that would otherwise be spent from the city budget. That's kind of what I was trying to say, rather than taking a shortcut, which I shouldn't do. Thank you.
Mike Taylor, go ahead.
Sounds like we need a motion on this for the general meeting, so we'll just have to vote on which we do. Thanks.
So we'll pull it off consent agenda, and we will put in a 2% risk tolerance. And if folks want to change that to 3%, or if they want to change that to make 3% distribution, I guess they can do that. But we'll go with the keeping our risk the same, realizing that we'll have smaller distribution in the future, and that'll be the motion that's presented, and we'll vote on it that way. If that, Mike, go ahead.
Yeah, I'd suggest that since the change would be to the higher risk tolerance, that your motion be for going to the higher risk tolerance in order to maintain the 3%. And then if we vote no on that, then we just stick with right where we are anyway, which we then just have to drop down to spending to offering 2% or hoping to offer 2%. Does that make sense? In other words, we'd be voting on what would the motion would be to change, and if it's turned down, then it stays the same.
Well, Phoebe is trying to figure out how this was work, because we've got all these different asset classes, and also we're trying to figure out what would be
have you done two different versions of resolutions? Like, I'd put two different versions of a resolution, and one with the current asset classes and one with the changes asset classes that would have the increased risk.
We can do an A and B.
Yeah, it sounds like that's the way we have to go, is maybe a version A and version B, because the risk is inherent in the asset classes. So I guess how best to identify this would be maintaining the risk that we have, or increasing the risk for and then maintaining distribution. So if you can frame it that way for us, when we have the version A and B, that would probably be the best way for us to approach it at the meeting. Does that sound okay with everybody? Susan, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Yeah, I just had a quick question for Phoebe. Thank you, oh awesome treasurer, for providing that report. It was a lot to go through. What did I see somewhere that the return on the investment for the first 6 months of this year was minus 1.4%? Did I read that right?
Mm-hmm. But when we do the endowment fund grant calculations, it's not just, it's based on a number of years, not just 1 year.
Okay, any other comments or questions? Okay, let's move it. We're moving on to the next set of them. There'll be NCOs moving money around for our road maintenance funds. And I don't know, Phoebe may want to talk about that a little bit. And then also our AMLIPS FY21 R&R repair and replacement contributions. So those are all scheduled for consent agenda for introduction. Phoebe, did you want to cover these three real quick?
This first NCO is returning our unused FY20 funds back to the AMLIP account. We do this every year, and it's just kind of a clean break between the fiscal years if we zero out 1 year's funds, 1 year's road maintenance budget, and then pull the funds out for the next fiscal year. So that's what this is, returning just under $5,500 back to our encumbered road maintenance account. And then the next NCO does the opposite and pulls the money out of the encumbered account for the next fiscal year. Normally we would, this time of year, pull out the full budget and then return any funds that got replaced by National Forest Receipts funds the following spring or summer or whenever they end up showing up. I suggest instead that we zero out this account. This is the last of our excess National Forest Receipts funds from other years that can only be used on road maintenance. And this is the end of them. And so I would say I would suggest we zero out this account, and then as we use up these funds, then we can do a separate NCO later that would pull funds out of our AMLIP road maintenance unencumbered account. And if we wait and do that later, then they can continue to grow. And we'll just do an NCO for those additional funds later this fiscal year. So those are the two road maintenance ones. And this third one, I don't know if you guys want to do this now or not. This is the just under 25 grand that is in our adopted budget that goes into our AMLIP repair and replacement account. So the advantage to doing it now is that it starts earning money because it's not in our checking account where it earns $10 or $20 a month for the entire account. It would go into the repair and replacement account and be able to grow. The advantage to doing it later is people might feel better if that money wasn't transferred out yet until we can see how the FY21 budget is behaving. I would recommend pulling the money, putting it over there. If we had some kind of dire reason to pull it back out, we of course could do that through a subsequent NCO. But that's what this dollar amount here, just under 25 grand, is what is in the FY21 budget for all of the calculated repair and replacement costs for each department. So these road maintenance ones we should do now for sure, and then if the council would rather delay this repair and replacement transfer, that's fine.
Go ahead, Susan.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Question for Phoebe. If we pull this $24,772 out of the FY21 budget, what does that do to the bottom line deficit for FY21. It increases it by $24,772, right?
No, it's already in the budget, so it won't affect the deficit at all. It's already contributing to the deficit. So it's already line itemed into the budget, and this would just be carrying out the adopted budget. It would not increase the deficit.
But if we leave it there, it offsets the deficit by $24,772, correct?
If you change the budget to be zero instead of $24,000, then it would be offset. But right now the budget is not at zero, it's at
$24,772. I guess asking for council member input on whether or not we, it seems to me like there's no problem with us doing this right now. Like Phoebe said, if something bad happens, we can always do an NCO to put more money in. But it seems like we budgeted for this. It's in our budget. We're just executing our budget like we said we were. So if there's no objection, I'm going to have Phoebe include this in the meeting agenda. And if council members want to remove it from consent agenda and discuss it fully and have a full vote, well, then we can do that too. Any other council comment on this? Okay, next is, Phoebe, did you wanna, do we need to talk about establishing our CARES Act? That's gonna be public hearing and setting that up. Do we need to discuss that here as a group? I don't think so. Let's pull, the FY21-03 NCO AMLIP repair and replace off consent agenda. We'll put that under new business along with our endowment fund asset allocation plan. Those two will be taken off consent and put on new business. I don't think we need to discuss the AMLIP account. We'll be taking public hearing on that and establishing our AMLIP CARES account. That's something that Phoebe recommended so that we can makes it easier for her to do bookkeeping on the AMLIP accounts, on the CARES Act in our AMLIP accounts. Wanted to discuss this next item up here. 7B. Oh, I'm sorry. 7B, approval of our ADEC solid waste 5-year permit renewal. Do we have Paul on? Was he going to talk about this, or is Tom? Okay. Paul, did you want to?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, Paul, we can hear you loud and clear.
Okay, and this is something that happens every 5 years. It's just updating the documents. It's a requirement of DEC to renew your operating permit to dispose of solid waste in your community. So this is something I've been doing for 20 years. I'm fine with it on consent agenda. It doesn't really have any huge changes from last year. I just updated it with some nice aerial photograph. You can see that Sean did with his drone, and it's a good update. It really, the council's action is just to approve the mayor's signature
of
renewal form. Really?
I can hear
says
you,
I'm still doing it. Okay, so yeah. Well, I mean, Susan, maybe she can get with me later, but it's pretty straightforward. So the council action is just to approve the mayor's signing of the renewal application, and those other documents are just supporting that. The operating plan and the food waste composting plan just support that. So pretty straightforward. It'd be easy to put on the consent agenda, and then it's taken care of for 5 years. And yeah, that's all I got, unless there's any questions.
Any questions for Paul? I see thumbs up and applause for you. Good job, Paul. Thanks.
I'll take it. Thank you.
Apologies, Paul, for skipping you over. I'm sorry. Unless it's highlighted, it blows right by me. Sorry. Let's go on to the next item here. We would need to discuss, and I think Travis, you might want to lead us on the discussion here. This is public information officer for EOC program and a position description. So, Travis, if you want to lead us on this, and we'll go with.
All right, thank you, Mr. Mayor. So I've took lots of listening to you guys talk about having a compliance officer and all of those suggestions that you were having, and kind of like came up with a position that is already inside of the Emergency Operations Center, which is a public information officer. And thought that maybe this would be a good middle ground for that type of thing. My vision was, we can't give out any of those forms or declarations to follow up on quarantines or what people have done. But this could be a person that met ferries, seaplanes, planes, private planes, whatever the case might be, Alaska Airlines, and handed out public information on the city side of it, on that, statements from the mayor, what operations are going on, like what Toshco's operations are, the Sunny, and so on. They could be the first line of contact for most public information type stuff the first line of contact, and then direct the right information to the right person if needed, or be able to answer most of those questions, such as traveling in and answering the general questions that I get all day long. Help make flyers and help do all that stuff. Put a fresh voice and some fresh ideas as far as flyers and imaging and wordage and all of that stuff out there, so that maybe people want to read that stuff outside of what I'm saying all the time. But basically, it's somebody to just answer questions and promote positive information on people coming into town and give them a direction on what the city wants and answer those questions and do all that good stuff. So I know you guys probably got a few questions on it, so I'm more than happy to try to answer them. And I've worked with a few, with Mike on rewording some of this stuff and trying to make it work. So go ahead.
Okay, first hand I saw was Joe Vanderzanden. Go ahead, Joe.
I agreed with Travis. Compliance officer is the exact opposite of the direction we want to go. It's a can of worms. But question I had was, if we did get some of this testing, whether it's pool testing or citywide or whatever, could this PIO play somewhat of a major part in that. Would that fit the description?
Sorry, Joe, I just missed the last part of the question you asked there.
Yeah, I was wondering if a public information officer could be used a fair amount in the operation of testing, whether it's pool testing or something that search is going to come up with. It seems to me like there would be a lot of record keeping or rounding people up or whatever it's going to take. And I wondered if that's something that could be taken care of by that person.
Yeah, they could definitely help out in that scenario. For sure, it would help alleviate a lot of all of that stuff. Yes, is my answer. It would help with a lot of documentation and a lot of random other little tasks that go on within my small operation that I run. It would just, I think it'd be beneficial. I've heard this, a few people have wanted this to, a similar type position or something like this to happen. So yeah, I'm just trying to promote it in more of a positive way than the compliance side, and maybe having somebody else meeting those planes outside of our screeners, because they're only meeting certain planes. This would just help with that promotion of the education and get that stuff out on our city side. And they could if we need to, they could try to organize a group of volunteers that could help them or help this person do this job and so on. But yeah, and just so you guys know, I've already reached out to Search to talk about pool testing, and they're going to reach back, and they've got a, Search has a good idea of what they should do for our community. So this person could already be working on that if we had this and follow through on part of this stuff. And yeah, so any more questions?
Yeah, thanks, Travis. I see Joe Clark has his hand up. Joe, do you have a question for Travis?
Yes, Travis, would this be a full-time, part-time job, and would it, what would be the pay, and who would be able to pull the plug on it? Would you oversee hiring and firing on such a, on this position?
They would work underneath me inside of the incident command system in our EOC. So anything that they would put out would have to be approved by myself, which I also run through Cal for anything that I feel he wouldn't want out there anyways. As far as hiring him, I would probably work this with Tom, since he's our kind of runs human resources at the same time. So I would still work this through the city system. As far as pay goes, that's something that I would, this would be a CARES Act fund. So I would like your guys' help on that. And as far as hours go, I think that initially, while the season's hot and going for us right now, it could be, up to 6 hours a day, I think. And then those hours could probably be reduced down to more part, even, 4 hours in the end of the season. And I think it could run at least until the end of December, as the CARES money is available. And if we get more CARES funding in the future, maybe it could be extended to help out in this scenario, but I think that would be a good time to pull it. And if we have problems with this person, I think that I would have no reason or no problem getting rid of them and trying to find another person for the position. Whoever it is has to represent the city of Gustavus in a positive and professional manner. So.
Thank you.
Susan, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Mayor. I really need to see a fiscal note on this proposal. It's one thing to say it's CARES Act funding, but that's a reimbursement program. So, if we're going to expand our personnel line and look for reimbursement from CARES Act money, we need to be figuring that into the total of what we're allocating in the CARES Act money. So my first question is, I'd really like to see a fiscal note on just exactly how much this position is going to cost. Secondly, my second concern is about, Travis knows about, you know, the EOC side of things, but we already have a person who has in their job description being the public information officer for the city, who is highly trained to make sure that we're complying with public records archiving and documentation requirements. So having a public information officer outside of the city requirements for compliance with state law makes me very uncomfortable. And I'm not quite sure how to address that, but somehow if we're going to stand up a position to be distributing public documentation, we need to make absolutely certain that we're complying with what state law says about, you know, city information is different than just information that might be on the fire department's website. So I'd like to hear more about how we could address that. Thank you.
Yeah, so real fast on that side of it, this would alleviate a lot of the little things that I make Phoebe and, or don't make them do, but they voluntarily do for me as far as working, adding things to the website and posting things to the news group, which I finally figured out how to do. And a couple of the other small tasks that actually take a few hours of their time to do, which they could be that are taking time away from getting their other normal job done. So this isn't going away from what the job description that Karen has as far as the city's public information officer. This is strictly just doing information for the COVID response and for making new flyers that say like this, like that my dad donated to the cause of wash your hands or wash your face or whatever you want to put on those things, and adding the approved flyers and packets that we've been handing out since the beginning of this whole operation, and just answering the questions that we're all answering. They would have to take all of the ICS classes, which would explain what you can and can't do as a public information officer. And if they were a trained PIO, I know there's a few of them in town. If we had a trained one, that would even be a benefit to this, to that role. But this is mainly going out and meeting people and being like a public image and answering those questions and making sure that people understand what the city is recommending on that side of it, instead of being that negative side of trying to figure out how do we get these lists and knock on people's doors to make sure they're following those rules. If we try to sell it in a positive educational way, I think we could do a lot better with it. And as far as the financial side of it, that's where I'm asking for help and direction from you guys on what you think or would want those hours to look like or pay to look like. I figured it wouldn't be any more than what the other temporary type people at the DRC make or such. So that's where I was thinking of that.
Susan, did you have a follow-up for?
Yeah, Travis, and thank you for doing this. I totally support the concept of having a positive greeting welcome and conveying information to people at the time of arrival. Totally support that concept, and thank you for doing that. I'm just trying to wrap my brain around what the fiscal implications are. So what do you see this person doing for 4 hours a day in October? Thank you.
First, I think we have to see where we are at in October as far as where the process is. If we don't need 4 hours a day, it could be reduced to 2 hours. And if we don't need the person at all, it could be reduced down to zero as far as I am concerned with the position. I think it could be used very valuable now. We will have people, you know, coming in from all over the place. And if town gets to the point where we have to do where the council wants to decide to do a 14-day quarantine for everybody coming in, this is the person that would be organizing and meeting those people and educating those people when they come in on what that quarantine is and what the city says that quarantine is. It would at least entail, I would assume, 1 to 2 flights a day, depending on what seaplanes flights are and the ferry. So, you know, you could at least get a couple hours a day on those flights and working to create new flyers and document anything that happens within the EOC. There's a lot of little things I think that could be taken off of Tom, myself, Phoebe, and Karen's plates. A little bit of everything could be taken off of our plates to add a few more hours to our normal job descriptions. And I that's all I got for that part right now.
Any other council comment on this? Well, I support the idea of this public information officer working within the ICS system. It's normal part of the ICS system and the way things work in the ICS system is to have a public information officer. And I think the side benefits of presenting a person out there who kind of shares expectations with our visitors of what we expect, of what the city expects of behavior and all that. I think that's all a really good thing. I also want to point out too that this would be a temporary employee. It's not like it's going to be a permanent addition to the staff. It's just going to be a temporary employee. We're not going to be paying health insurance and all that other stuff. So it's and since it is temporary, if like Travis said, if October comes along and there isn't a whole lot of work for them, well, it's a temporary employee. That would be end of the job. So I support this idea. I know folks wanted a compliance officer. There are some folks in town want somebody stronger, like a compliance officer, what have you. You know, I don't think that's going to be doable, but this is, and I think it's a good step forward. And, you know, if we pay them along the same lines of like we're paying our folks at the Alaska Airlines terminal, I think that's, you know, that's about what we've, you know, it just seems like that would be a good thing. And as far as the fiscal notes and how much this is going to cost, well, of course, staff is going to work this out and work more of this information through to us by our meeting on Monday. But this is just to get an idea of, you know, is this the right job description? Is this what they need to do? This is what we want them to do. I think it is. I reviewed it while Travis was writing it. So I think we're, you know, I think this is a good stroke. I think this is a good thing for us to try to do. Anyway, any other council comment? I see a thumbs up. Any other council comment? Okay, maybe Travis, working with Tom, you'll continue working this out, and then we'll have a job description to approve at our meeting, and then we can talk about salaries and all too, I guess, at some point. Like I said, I envision it to be somewhere along the lines of what we're paying the folks at Alaska Airlines already. Okay, any other council comments? Travis, do you have enough from us? Travis and Tom, you have enough from
us? Yeah, I do. Thank you guys very much. If you guys have any comments or any ideas that you want that you think we could add into the job description, please send them my email my way, and we'll try to throw them in there, discuss, and I'll try to see what I can do. But thank you.
Okay, before we get off on the further things down the list, I just wanted to really cover this last thing here real quick. This is our list of additional things we may want to consider. We began this at our last work session. I've had some conversations with folks and heard from Shelley and Mike and Joe Vanderzand, and all chimed in development of this list. It's a little bit different than what we first saw a few weeks ago. I sent this out, Karen sent this out in the work session packet last week. These last items, backup plans for surge infections, I said those still need to be, there's an issue of what when things get bad, that still, you know, that needs to be defined a little bit. Mike sent me an email over the weekend about what he thought when things get worse might mean. It was fairly subjective list, but he asked me to send it on to DHSS for their thoughts on it, and we did that. I haven't heard back from DHSS on that suggestions from Mike. On here, we talked about some additional stuff. We'd already talked about the PIO already, and we talked about city-sponsored testing. Some of the other things that was still to be discussed and folks wanted to have a discussion about that I didn't really know what to do with, but that was civil fines or perhaps procedures for making businesses responsible. I'm not sure where that one goes right now, but I didn't really get any input on that. City sponsored testing, we talked about that. Hiring of a PIO, we talked about that. So, and then this last one of quarantine relocation of a person testing positive and medical transport out of our community. We haven't really discussed that any further as well. So again, this was just a list of what we've been working on or what we thought we would be working on. Some of this stuff on this list is stuff that we can do through a resolution already. Like for instance, requiring cloth masks, we can do that through a resolution already. So anyway, more discussion. What's the wish of the council? How do we want to proceed? Like I said, I haven't heard back from DHSS on what we can, on, you know, instituting a standard or requiring a 14-day quarantine on all travelers if things get worse, and haven't heard back from them on that yet. But anyway, council comments. Joe Vanderzand, go ahead.
I just had a question on number five there, require 14-day quarantine for travelers from out of state with no test exception. What does that mean, no test exception?
Well, the way it was explained to me was that you wouldn't be able to do the testing to, you know, you couldn't do the 3-day test before and the secondary test you know, a week later or whatever, that it would just be a straight 14-day quarantine, no ability to test, and go and have a shorter quarantine time. Joe Clark, go ahead.
Yes, I feel that any further restrictions are unnecessary. I think what we already have in place is working very well. I don't like this, these mandates, further restrictive mandates, one bit. So I'll leave it at that.
Mike Taylor, go ahead.
thanks a lot, Mr. Mayor, for sending that stuff on to DHSS. Those requests just put us in position to take further action if we need to. And I hope that we don't need to take any additional, putting additional travel restrictions on. It does look like our businesses are actually doing a good job from what I hear. Attitudes are good, and they're trying to prove that they can make the existing system work, and that's great. It's possible that the situation in the state may get so bad that we need to clamp down further on travel, and if the governor doesn't, we may need to do it locally. So either of those five or six would put us in position, if we are authorized in advance to do them, then the council could make the determination that it is something that we need to do. I, again, hope that we don't have to do it. I would support, though, a resolution requiring cloth masks to be worn in all enclosed public spaces and outdoors where social distancing cannot be maintained. I think that's something that's being instituted in many states across the U.S. right now, where they have rapidly expanding COVID issues. It's already being done in at least many of the businesses here in Gustavus. I think it's a good thing for us to do at this point to help make sure that we don't have to do something a lot tougher. So I think doing a resolution on that would be worth doing. And then we position ourselves to do the quarantine, one or the other of those quarantine versions, if we think that the other measures just aren't working. And again, I hope we don't have to go there. Thanks.
Travis, you raised your hand. Go ahead.
Thanks. I just had a quick thought that I just want to remind people that I don't have the exact date, but I know at the end of August is the last flight for Alaska Airlines, and that's the last day that we screen out-of-state people coming into Gustavus. So the council might also, in this type of plan or protection, looking for further additional restrictions, is to think that after the last Alaska Airlines flight comes in, how are we going to check those passengers and what we're going to do there for, like we did earlier with the travel declaration or such. So something for you guys to think about in the future, what we want to do for those restrictions, if we want to implement those.
Tom Williams, go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, thank you, Mayor. I was looking for some clarification on number three. Is the suggestion that we would require masks in private businesses and on private lands? When I'm looking at this, it says in all enclosed public spaces. I just wanted to know if Mike's intent was to try and require people to wear masks, the city requiring people to wear masks in places like Clove Hitch, Toshco, the Fireweed, and outdoors on public land, a gathering, you know, somebody's private property.
Mr. Mayor, yeah, the answer is yes. We would mandate the use of cloth masks in all places where the public is going into businesses that are indoors and outdoors where the distances cannot be maintained. I'm not saying that we are going to try to come up with some hard enforcement version for this. I say we mandate it. It's an expectation. And those places that don't comply with that are probably going to face some pressure from the public to comply. But many of them are. I see that going on in Toshco, for example. And when I've been over there, it's and I think that makes the public feel much better about going to a business when the business is doing everything they can to make it safe for the public and their employees. So the answer, long answer.
Yeah, thank you, Mike. I think it's problematic for the city to try to tell a private business or private property owner what to do in terms of wearing a mask. Perhaps this is something you've already discussed with the city attorney. If not, I think it is something we would want to have reviewed before we adopted a resolution. Just my 2 cents worth. Thank you.
Yeah, we could certainly have them review it. But remember, it's being done all over the United States. Many states and municipalities are doing this. I don't think it's seen as any big problem with anybody's rights or anything. And especially it's an expectation we're setting forth as a mandate. We're not putting it in ordinance or anything like that, but it sets an expectation that, again, many businesses are already doing.
Brittany, go ahead.
Thank you. As far as requiring folks to wear the cloth masks, I guess in an ideal world, that would go over really smoothly and people would comply. But I don't see that being realistic. I don't see anything changing from what's already happening now. Some people do and some people don't. And some businesses have been really good about requiring their employees and customers to wear masks, which I really appreciate. But without consequences for not following the rules, I don't see any difference, I guess. So as much as I would like to request that we put that forward to businesses in the community, I guess I don't really see the point.
Any other council comment on this? Go ahead, Susan.
I have no problem with requiring that people wear masks in public spaces when social and outdoors when social distancing isn't available. And if there are private businesses who don't want to go along with that, fine, they'll do that. But I have no problem with requiring that, and we'll see what happens. But I think for the protection of the members of the community, we should do that. So I support Mike's idea of putting forward a resolution.
Okay, Mike, if you want to work with staff on, and maybe on putting a resolution together for the next, for our business meeting, and hopefully get it in front of the attorney for his review as well. And then we'll just vote on it, I guess.
Great. I'll send you a draft tomorrow.
Okay, sounds good. Okay, anything else on this list that we need to discuss any? Susan, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I also agree with we should ask for the authority to impose additional 14-day quarantines should the situation require it. And ask for that now, and we can debate what those conditions would be later. So there's a lot of community request for that to happen, and I support that idea.
Again, for the record, Susan, it's that's at DHS for them to weigh in on right now, and we'll see what happens. Okay, any other council? Okay, that brings us down to Susan. Your report on COVID-19 economic stabilization task.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I will put together a July report for the council and get it put into the packet tomorrow. If I can find somewhere in Juneau where I can upload it to my city council email. The Gustavus COVID-19 Economic Stabilization Task Force is a council work group consisting of myself and Brittany Canamore and Joe Clark. And the task force has conducted a series of 4 informal online conversations amongst Gustavus community members on stabilizing our local economy and providing for a long-term recovery from the financial impacts of the COVID virus. The group met on May 16 and 21 and June 4 and 18 with a total of 58 participants. And I also attended the Juneau Assembly's COVID-19 Economic Stabilization Task Force Group meeting on June 26. The first 2 meetings in May here explored ideas for revitalizing our tourism industry by increasing visitation and extending season and length of stay. The strongest ideas centered around developing Gustavus as a destination for gatherings, such as festivals and conference events. And one group may move forward with establishing a recurring Gustavus Music Festival. Another group is slowly building up Gustavus resources for experiential science adventuring and environmental leadership. The third session on June 4th focused on our food production capacity and food security. One group is moving forward with ideas particularly geared toward better securing our winter food supply, and they're working with Brittany to formulate a proposal for possible CARES Act funding support. Brittany, you want to say anything about the food group?
Sure, thanks, Susan. I had a meeting, about a week and a half ago with Judy Brakel and a new young person in town, Tanner, who's working with the Arete Project, Laura Marcus's nonprofit. And we discussed the root cellar idea and potentially buying fish that's already processed from Excursion Inlet. And I'm following up with Jim Makoviak on that because he has some experience buying fish that's already been processed just as like a personal supply. So looking into that for the community. And then with the root cellar idea, Tanner has been working on grant applications and has already received I think $5,000 in funding, and as of now, the root cellar wouldn't have one direct owner. It's kind of up in the air. It seems like a lot of different entities don't necessarily want to take full ownership of it. So we discussed potentially putting like $3,000 to $5,000 towards it from the CARES Act from the city. So the city would have partial ownership, and then that it would be a similar root cellar to what Sunnyside has, so partially buried like a Connex style. And it would, in theory, go on the GCC land. So that's all I've kind of got for now. I'm still following up, and I think you all know that I just got back from a trip, so I'm catching up on those emails now. But I can send out a report when I get more.
Okay, great. Thanks, Brittany. And then the final session of the first series of four focused on the two infrastructure projects rated with high priority in the council-sponsored December 2019 online infrastructure survey, being developing a safe public drinking water supply and improving our roads. And that conversation was structured in two parts. For safe public drinking water supply, we posited that we have two problems to solve: obtaining a safe water supply for PFAS-compromised residents and resolving a National Park Service conflict for drinking water source. And the components of that discussion were going to be developing a new water source, planning for access, distribution, testing, and reporting, a $60,000 study plus contractual advising and assistance, and planning and funding for some $500,000 to $600,000 construction project. That's on the drinking water side. For roads, the components were obtaining a source of good rock material, engineering and LIDAR assistance with planning upgrades, maybe another $60,000 study, and obtaining construction funding for a road repair upgrade project around $600,000. The outcome of that conversation was that many community members are aware of the problem, but the status of our roads is so primitively bad that the cost and magnitude of addressing our roads, $300,000 to $500,000 per mile just for material, is too daunting and entirely out of reach. The consensus appeared to be that efforts to advance both the water and roads improvements would both be advanced by waiting for the results of the LIDAR data survey to inform our strategies. And preliminary results are expected on that within the next 60 days, if I've got that correct from Whitney, with full reporting by next spring. And at the two-hour meeting of the Juneau Assembly's COVID-19 Economic Stabilization Task Force meeting on June 26th, it was apparent that Juneau is struggling with many of the same issues as Gustavus, particularly with respect to reserving first-round CARES Act funding to be available for relief of municipal debt should the current national legislation pass that allows for it. They are taking a very cautious approach. And this completes the initial series of community conversations regarding immediate relief and long-term recovery from the financial impacts of the virus. The task force stands ready to further explore community ideas in this area should the council desire the work group to do so. So, over to you all.
Any council comments for Susan on this? I see applauses and thumbs up again. Okay, doesn't look to be anything else. I just wanted to mention to folks, somebody's got a chance to pop in the office tomorrow. There's some checks that need to be signed. I signed them all. We need one more. So if one of you are or by the office tomorrow, maybe pop in and sign those for Phoebe. That would be great. Other than that, if there's nothing else, we stand adjourned. Oh, wait a minute. Oh, the famous list. Here we go. I don't really see anything on here that requires us to talk about right now. I did notice that, does anybody know about the intertie? It looks like it's done. I drove out to the park. What are those, what are the electric boxes all the way along the way? There's electric boxes going all the way to the park now. Little transformer boxes. It's brand new. First time I've seen it. Does anybody know about that? There's a little transformer box all the way out on the park road. Anyway, I just saw that. I was just wondering if anybody knew about that. Oh, go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, I have not seen that, but I can find out for you and I'll let you know.
They were just little boxes all the way along the way.
Mr. Mayor, I could comment on the EV charger situation.
Oh yeah, haven't got down there, but go ahead, Mike. I know you had some talks with folks at AP&T.
Yeah, I had my hopes up on that this might be something we could install a public charger that would be used for attracting people with electric vehicles from Juneau who want to come over for recreation purposes here or stay a few days. But it turns out that we can't, if we were to do that, the city would have to pay for the cost of electricity. There's no practical means of charging the user for plugging in their car to that. There are regulatory issues that if you are reselling electricity, you have to be a utility. And if you're selling it to more than 25 people, which conceivably could occur. So what's more, the systems for billing for the use of such a charger are complicated and problematic, according to APC. They looked into it and they've decided not even to try it themselves, that it wasn't worth it. So Skagway has put in four free chargers, but the city is paying for the electricity apparently for those, just because they get enough people coming through that, on from the Alaska Highway, that it's worth it to them. But it does not seem to be a practical thing for us here, so we might as well take it off the list.
Okay, that sounds good. We'll pull that off the list. I think that's it. Most of the stuff I know we're the dog ordinance that's still kind of on a back burner. The gravel extraction, we're still kind of waiting on that. Had the question about the intertie. And then we heard about economic stabilization task force just now. So, and then also the DHSS request that sent in earlier as well. So I think that's it. Got the EV charger to remove, and then I noticed the business without permit needs to be removed as well, because I think we've taken care of that as well already as well. So is there anything else the council members need to want to now? Okay, doesn't appear to be so. We are adjourned. Thanks, everybody. Thanks for hanging in there, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks for hanging in there.